Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
We're working in partnership with Charles Tirrett across the Ashes. As part of the partnership, Charles Tirrett are offering the chance to win a £500 voucher to spend on their website. To enter the competition, simply follow the link in the podcast description and also look out for it on our social channels. It's an amazing prize. I'd very much recommend getting involved, but hurry up. The competition closes very, very soon. Hello and welcome to a bonus Christmas episode of the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast. We'll briefly run through all the news from the world of cricket this week before getting to the fun bit, answering your questions. We had one golden rule for the questions. As long as they're not about the men's Ashes in any way at all, they're good to go. I'm Yaz Rahn, and with me today over Zoom is the managing editor of Wisden.com, Ben Gardner, the magazine editor of Wisden Cricket Monthly, Joe Harmon, and the editor-in-chief of Wisden Cricket Monthly, Phil Walker. First off, Phil's just tested positive for the cron, so I should ask, how are you doing, Phil? Are you okay?
Yeah, I'm all right. I've got the Rona. Came through this morning. It's been in the post for a while. My wife has had it for the last week and a bit. So it's obviously kiboshed Christmas. But you know, I'm pretty confident that our brave boys down in Melbourne will do me a happy turn and turn this otherwise rather grim shit show into a rousing finale as we get through Christmas and into the new year.
Yeah, in a way, this could be one of your best Christmases ever if England pull it off at the MCG.
Yeah, it could be.
It could be. as much as I don't want to ruin this cheery festive special by talking about the men's Ashes, let's start with that and get it out of the way. I've not told Joe and Phil this, but I've got a timer on my phone. And when it hits the 10-minute mark, whatever we're talking about, where if someone's halfway through a sentence or whatever, that's it. That's the end of our men's Ashes chat.
Don't give Phil the first question then.
Let's start with the reported changes. Various journalists out there in Australia are reporting that England are set to make as many as four changes for the MCG test. Zach Crawley coming in at the top for one of Burns or Hamid. Ollie Pope dropping out probably for Johnny Bairstow. And Jack Leach and Mark Wood probably returning to the bowling attack. Joe, the last couple of days have bordered on farce on occasion, I think. Chris Silverwood defending England selections in both of the first two test matches. Dressing room leaks. Ali Martin in The Guardian reporting in detail about Silverwood getting very angry in the dressing room and going where no coach has ever gone before in daring to show replays of batters getting out. And then there's this video emerges today of Haseeb Ameed and Rory Burns batting the nets, batting on one leg 3 days ahead of a test match. What have you made of the last couple of days?
That last one I genuinely thought was a joke. I didn't really understand that. I saw that last night after a few drinks and sort of laughed without really understanding what I was laughing at. And then woke up and realised it was a genuine thing. You know, maybe that's the turning point in the Ashes. The leak thing was interesting. The detail in Ali's piece was extensive. Someone's obviously come out of that meeting and thought, I'm just going to tell the press about this. some of the little bits in there as well that, that someone has said the important thing is getting through the first 20 balls, and Joss Butler said, no, it's not. It's about batting for longer. I mean, is that genuinely a conversation that's been had? I mean, it didn't inspire me with a huge amount of confidence. And Chris Silverwood's refusal to acknowledge they've made any mistakes up to this point is hugely frustrating. I think people would probably have a lot more respect if he just held his hands up and said, look, we've got one or two things wrong. But they still plough on. The plan's working. We'll continue as we are. And the comeback is on.
The thing that's remarkable for me about that report is that it's deemed remarkable enough to leak and say, like as Yaz says, surely batters should be watching how they're getting out lots. I mean, I've had to watch Rory Burns' leg stump get ripped out about 50 times. It's only fair that he has to watch it one or two times as well. yeah, as you say, the whoever was saying like it's really like you've got to focus on those first 20 balls. And also that it's Butler saying, you know, we've got to focus a bit more. It does feel like it's something that should be the norm. Like after every game, you should maybe look at where you lost it and have a bit of a chat about it, rather than that being something that you think of doing when you're 2-0 down in the Ashes and everything's kind of all falling apart already.
I kind of wonder, who do you reckon is the most likely player to have said we just need to focus on the first 20 balls?
Ollie Pope for me.
Or based on their record, Rory Burns, given that we know once he gets past zero,
he's unstoppable, yeah.
He's unstoppable, although that can't be quite so true after the last few knocks. But
yeah, that is true. Phil, what have you made of the days since the Adelaide Test?
I agree with Ben, first and foremost. Ollie Pope is prime candidate, I would say, for that one, because of his obsession, the first 20 balls. I have to be absolutely honest with you here. I've had real life stuff to deal with, so I haven't really been following it that closely. I was so upset through the Adelaide Test match. You know, I wrote something kind of humorless and aggressive, but I stand by it regarding Silverwood's position. I think I wrote that after a day or two of the Adelaide Test match, and that risible not me gov press conference he gave rather articulates our concerns here. You know, he has been given a hell of a lot of responsibility, too much responsibility, and this kind of overload onto his shoulders, bearing in mind that he is a rookie at this level anyway, he has no international experience and is still, in terms of years, quite a young coach. It's shown to be the folly that we all kind of thought it was at the time, really. How can you be simultaneously the national selector and also the coach? There needs to be a kind of creative tension there. There needs to be clear demarcation between the two roles. I think that's obvious. And there isn't. And we wonder why. And we wonder if it's even slightly to do with finances. The ECB's not as rich as it once was. Either way, it's a botched job. And it's rather playing out like that. And I can understand the siege mentality on Silverwood's part. But he's not doing himself any favours, really, at the moment. As for the stuff that came out in Ali's piece, well, he did it really well, and his ear is very close to that dressing room, but I didn't think there was much in that personally. You know, if you're not throwing a few cups and saucers around the dressing room after stinking the place out for the last two or three weeks and playing only really a fraction of your quality from top to bottom, really, with one or two isolated exceptions, if you're not having a few harsh words being said, then there's something fundamentally amiss. So it's a good thing, right? It's a good thing. Absolutely, it's a good thing. I think changes are inevitable, but we'll probably come to that. I don't know. I'm aware that we're on the clock.
We've actually got 4 minutes left.
I wanted Zach Crawley in from the start. I know he averages about six and all the rest of it. Don't get me wrong. I don't think he's you know, he's Stan McCabe Mark II or anything, but I'd like to see him in. And there will probably be a change in the middle order as well, and obviously would have come back. My instinct is that they'll actually put up a better show of it in Melbourne than they have done, but that is starting from a very, very, very low base.
I wondered, actually, because obviously when there are leaks, you sort of wonder if that's a sign of, you know, discontent within the dressing room and that sort of thing. I actually wonder if this was sort of leaked as a kind of a good news kind of thing, like, No, look, we are concerned by this, we are trying to make it better. I'd also say that, yeah, as we were discussing before the show, that one thing that shows the folly of the sort of the coach selector combined job is the fact that England announced that T20I squad today. So Chris Silverwood has either sort of taken a, you know, half a day out in the middle of an Ashes tour, sort of sit down and wonder whether to pick Matt Parkinson or Liam Dawson for a West Indies squad a few months down the line, or he's just signed off something that probably Owen Morgan has sent to him. And either way, it shows just how ridiculous the situation is, basically, that like it is, especially in this era where, you know, no player can do it all, to expect a coach to be able to do it all and oversee it all is just ridiculous.
Yeah, I like to think that after giving the dressing room a very harsh talking to, that he was scrolling through Phil Salt's Lancashire Premier League records, deciding whether he or Tom Cole-Cadmore should be added to the squad. On Australia, there's some news. Mitchell Starc is an injury doubt, but will probably be fit for the Boxing Day test. Scott Boland, a 32-year-old seamer who's played 17 white ball games for Australia, has come into the squad as injury cover. And Justin Langer has backed Marcus Harris to come good. He'll play at the MCG. Harris averages 22.2 in Test cricket, which is one of the worst averages of all time for an opening batter who's played 10 or more Tests. But his career average is more than Crawley, Hamid and Sibley have averaged for England this year, so still probably getting the England team. And related to the series, Manus Labuschagne has gone top of the ICC Test batting rankings. It's the first time someone out of the Fab Four has gone top since November 2015, when AB de Villiers was ranked number one. Joe?
Yeah, also Hazelwood's out, isn't he? Which you didn't mention there. I think he's been ruled out of this Test match.
Has he definitely been ruled out?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Hazelwood's out as well.
Stay on top of it, guys.
And I think, yeah, the story I said was Hazelwood out, Starc likely to play.
Ben, you've got some insight on Labuschagne going top, kind of how that compares to some of the greats of the game.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very, very high rating that he's got at the moment. Like, very few players get above 900, and he's at 912, I think. So that's higher than Heaton ever achieved, higher than Lara ever achieved, higher than Tendulkar ever achieved. I mean, obviously the rankings are a bit flawed, and in that cutoff period he's basically only played in Australia with a couple of Tests in England, so there's other things to prove. But it does just show how remarkable the start to his career has been, I guess, that he's already up there and he's like still kind of only a baby in terms of Test matches played.
Mm. Nice one. Well, we've finished the Men's Ashes chat with a minute to go, so well done. We didn't need to hear the timer, which is excellent news. Moving on, England have announced a 16-man squad for their T20I series against West Indies, which starts 4 days after the Ashes ends. Paul Collingwood will be in charge for that trip. None of the Test guys are going. I'll read out the squad. It's Morgan, Moeen, Banton, Billings, Dawson, Garton, Chris Jordan, Saqib Mahmood, Mills, Gloucester seamer David Payne, Adil Rashid, Jason Roy, Phil Salt, Rhys Topley and James Vince. I guess the omission of Matt Parkinson's interesting. David Payne being in the squad's interesting again. I know he was in the squad for the ODI series against Pakistan, but he's not played. Not only he's not played international cricket, but I don't think he's played in any leagues outside of the T20 Blast and the 100. Any further takeaways from that squad from anyone?
Yes. When you say interesting, what are you really saying there? When and also when you're running through the list, how come David Payne gets his county and role before the use of his name? Are you trying to kind of indicate something here? Well, what are you trying to say?
I think it's likely that some of our listeners don't know who he is.
Okay. Well, I for one think that county stalwart, all-round lovely bloke and hero of the Shires, David Payne, who's been playing for about 11 or 12 years now at county level, it's far more important that he gets used to conditions in the Caribbean than someone like Matt Parkinson. Absolutely far more important that David Payne bowls those tricky middle overs in a T20 nonsense somewhere or other than Matt Parkinson, who is lovely. And I know that we bang on about him and we run the risk of being a bit hackneyed in this. But I mean, how many more times does this kid have to be rejected, ousted, thrown to the wolves, wrapped up in some bib and ferrying drinks around before people start to say, is there some kind of agenda at work here? It's baffling. It truly is baffling. Who cares? Who cares about the results of these games in March, really? Who gives a toss? Just have a look. Have a look at a couple of players when we are crying out for something or somebody that just offers a different skill set to what we've seen time after time after time. We know what does work and what doesn't work. We've seen it. I know it's a different format, but it has to be seen in the round.
Mm. Yeah, I guess one thing I'd say on Parkinson, I guess you could spin it positively and say that him not being included in the squad means that he's more likely to be able to play franchise cricket, something that he's not actually done that much of, considering how good he is.
Yeah, I mean, that's a potential silver lining, but that's not where England are coming from, is it? England are coming from that they don't want him in the squad for whatever reason. It's, you know, I think it's different. I think we should separate Parkinson, the potential test cricketer, and Parkinson, the white ball cricketer, because with the red ball, it is still all about potential and what he might be able to do. I think T20 cricket, he's further down the line than that. And it feels like we're getting to the point where Parkinson's going to perhaps just have to accept that his England career is on hold until Owen Morgan decides that he's going to call it a day. That for whatever reason, Morgan doesn't appear to rate him based on the selections. The fact that Liam Dawson is getting called up for that squad in the Caribbean, I mean, what do they expect to learn from that? And then, I mean, looking further ahead, if Jos Buttler comes in, Jos Buttler obviously has played with Parkinson at Lancashire, has captained him at Manchester Originals, will perhaps hold him in higher esteem than Morgan seems to. But it is an odd one. I guess Morgan would say that there is another T20 World Cup around the corner already, October, November next year. So he wants to just pick the players who he thinks are going to be in that squad. And he thinks Dawson is ahead of Parkinson. So, you know, that's the choice they've made. But it is a confusing one to get our head around. And you know, we do exist in a bit of an echo chamber here, in that we all think he should get a go, and we all tell each other we think that, and then that reinforces it. But we're not the only ones who think that. Increasingly, Owen Morgan is in the minority, but obviously his opinion holds a huge amount of sway. And as Ben said earlier, it'd be fascinating to know how much impact Chris Silverwood even has in those selections.
Yeah, it is a tricky one that England are in, because there are so many global white ball tournaments, as we've discussed before, from now until like 2030, there's like one a year. So they do have to balance giving game time to those players who are realistically in contention, but like slightly further down the line, and also giving experience to new players and seeing how good they might be. And I think that they have generally leaned too much towards the former. So it's not just Parkinson. There's guys like Harry Brook would have been quite nice to see in this squad, having had such a good summer last year. And you look at, it's not just Dawson, like it is possibly guys like James Vince, who are likely to be sort of reserves come that T20 World Cup time, but who England do know what they're about when they do. Like, this would be a chance to properly experiment. And it feels more second string than experimental, I guess, which is, you know, it's not an awful thing, but it's just something that they have tended to do, I guess.
On a couple of the young-ish batters who are included, Tom Banton's recall is interesting, I guess. He's been out of form for quite a while. He's not got many runs going back probably 18 months, really. And also, Phil Salt, he's had a really, really good winter, hasn't he, Ben?
Yeah, he was he had an extraordinary T10 campaign where he was scoring at sort of like well over two runs a ball, and was pretty good in the Lancashire Premier League as well. There was quite a fun video, I don't know if you saw, of him being dismissed by, is it Benura Fernando, I think? And then Benura Fernando does the Salt Bay thing, like, you know, the if you're watching on YouTube, the Turkish chef does, obviously a reference to his surname. But yeah, Phil Salt's really good, and England will obviously love the way he goes about his cricket in a sort of Jason Roy-esque, like, me getting out literally does not matter, I don't care about that at all, I just want to try and score as many runs off the balls I'm lucky enough to face as possible. And that's, and England will really, really rate that and see him as an heir to that sort of role, I think.
A week ago, England announced a 17-strong squad for the multi-format Women's Ashes series that takes place in the new year, as well as an A squad that will tour Australia at the same time. I'll run through those two squads quickly. The full Ashes squad is Heather Knight, Tammy Beaumont, Maya Bouchier, Catherine Brunt, Kate Cross, Freya Davies, Charlie Dean, Sophia Dunkley, Sophie Eccleston, Tash Farrant, Sarah Glenn, Amy Jones, Nat Skiver, Anya Shrubsole, Manny Villiers, Lauren Rinfield-Hill and Danny Wyatt. The A squad is Emily Arlott, Lauren Bell, Alice Capsey, Alice Davidson-Richards, Georgia Elwis, Kirsty Gordon, Eve Jones, Beth Langston, Emma Lamb, Byrony Smith, Ellie Threkeld and Izzy Wong. I guess it's interesting that Boucher is in the main squad. She's not played much international cricket and her domestic record isn't great, but they clearly rate her. And Charlie Dean caps off an amazing year. She didn't have a pro contract at the start of 2021 and now she's going on an Ashes tour. And Ben, some good stories in that A squad as well.
Yeah, well, obviously the one that stands out is Alice Capsey, who obviously talked about a bit, 16. Is she turned 17 yet? I'm not sure.
Yeah, she's 17 now.
But still remarkable either way. Nice that Kirsty Gordon's sort of back in the frame. And Eve Jones as well, who's sort of been sort of a domestic kind of try it, I guess, for years. She's long been sort of rated as sort of like the best and most reliable uncapped batter in the country. But they've sort of wondered if she hasn't quite had the power game, if she's more of like a player who can bat time. People often said that she might be more suited to test cricket, but then there's not many women's tests that get played, and they tend to then be picked from the existing pool of women's players. And now with just a few more tests being played, maybe that's helped her come into the reckoning too.
India's test series in South Africa gets going on Boxing Day. Some injury news from South Africa. Anrik Nokia has been ruled out of the series. South Africa will probably end up fielding an attack of pace attack of Rabada Ngidi and the returning Dwan Olafur, which will be a storyline to watch out for in that series. India don't have Rohit Sharma, who's also injured. Mayank Agarwal will likely partner KL Rahul up top, but it'll be interesting to see who bats in the middle order. Rahane is no longer the vice captain, so his position is more precarious than ever. Vihari is seen as an overseas specialist, and Iyer did really well in that New Zealand series earlier this winter. There's also no Ravindra Jadeja, so the balance of that India side isn't that easy to predict. Joe, that's a really big series, isn't it? India have never won in South Africa before. They lost in 2018, and despite India's recent good results and South Africa struggling a little bit, that could still be quite a tight series in South African conditions.
Yeah, it should be. It's gutting that Nokia is not part of that series. That had been we've not seen that much of him in Test cricket. South Africa haven't played a huge amount of Test cricket, and him up against that gun Indian batting lineup would have been really kind of box office stuff. So that's a real shame. It's come at an interesting time for Indian cricket, with Kohli now only the Test captain and not having the bits. This will be a real opportunity for him to kind of, if there's any suggestion that his grip has been loosened on power in Indian cricket, if he can come away with a series win in South Africa, as you say, they're India's first, then that will really kind of reaffirm his status in Indian cricket. And also, he needs some runs as well. We've talked about that 100 is what, 2 years now, more than 2 years since an international 100 in any format. He will be more desperate than ever, given recent developments, to kind of correct that record and come away with a series win. It will probably be a lot more interesting to watch than the Ashes. Oh no, I was meant to announce.
You're not allowed to mention it anymore. You're not allowed to mention it anymore. Moving on, some news, some bit sad from Pakistan. Pakistan opener Abid Ali was rushed to hospital after complaining of chest pains during a Qadi Azam Trophy clash. He is currently in a stable condition, has had a couple of successful operations. Elsewhere, 19-year-old Muhammad Herrera became the second youngest Pakistani to hit a first-class triple century. He's the nephew of Shoaib Malik, so remember the name. I think the Pakistani first-class structure is a bit like the Australian one. There are only six or so teams, so the quality is quite high. If you look through the list of players in the scorecards, there are a lot of players you'd recognise from international cricket. And in New Zealand, Ajaz Patel has been ruthlessly discarded after his historic tenfer. He's not been included in their squad for the Bangladesh series that's coming up shortly. New Zealand reverting their tried and tested team balance on home soil. I think it's still a bit harsh not to have him in the squad. They named 13 players. You could have at least have him there. Ben, you enjoyed a moment of Trent Bolt winning a game with the bat today.
Yeah, and a frankly ridiculous game of cricket. So Northern Brave against Canterbury Knights. I think they changed their names a few times, those New Zealand regions. But yeah, I think those are the two teams. Looked like it was sewn up quite a few times for Northern Brave. They bowled out Canterbury Knights for 107, I think. And then Katane Clark, I think is how you pronounce the opening batter's name. He got off to a flyer, so they were 30 for naught after two overs. That's already nearly a third of the runs down, two overs gone. Then he hobbles off, retired, hurt. They still seem like they're going to get there. I think when there's eight balls left, they need 10 runs to win. They got five wickets in hand. That should just be completely sewn up. And then they end up losing four wickets for three runs, I think, in a space of six balls. So it's down to the last two. Katane Clark walks back in, having hobbled off injured. He'd actually, as he hobbled off injured earlier, he'd given his batting gloves to some kids in the crowd, presumably thinking that his day was done. He wouldn't be needed again. The game was won. But I don't know if he had to ask for the gloves back, or if he just might have had a second pair, I suppose. But he comes back in, gets a single to get Trent Bolt at number 10 back on strike, who has only hit two sixes in his T20 career before today in 147 games, proceeds to hit the last ball of the game, 4-6. The commentary is amazing. Sort of an Ian Smith-like voice, I guess, just shouting. I think there's one phrase he lifts exactly from Ian Smith, but the best bit is just the end, which goes, "Trent Bolt, I am losing my mind. An amazing moment, and yeah, I take it all back with Super Smash. It's the tournament everyone should be watching.
Well, excellent. Well, now we're on to the fun bit of the show, where we're answering listeners' questions. These were amazing, so thank you so much for all of them. Let's start with one on county cricket. Jill asks, who is everyone's favourite 90s county cricketer? I'll accept answers from the 2000s if the young'uns are too young. Joe, do you want to go first?
I mean, I could be anyone from Kent's 1995 Axe Equity and Law Sunday League winning side, really. But I thought I would go for Trevor Ward, who a few of our listeners might not have heard of. He was kind of hard-hitting opener, ahead of his time in some ways, although not like that good. So he'd come out and kind of smash a quick 30 off 20 balls, often opening with Matthew Fleming. So that was always good fun on a Sunday afternoon. Moved on to Leicester later on. And I remember, because I would have been about 10 or 11 at the time, and I just could not understand why he wasn't in the England side at all. Just absolutely clouded by what I saw in front of me, which actually wasn't all that much either. So he was definitely a favourite. But Matt Walker, I liked all of them, but Nigel Long, I didn't like Nigel Long. Always had an issue. I never thought he was worth his place on the side.
Do you have a problem with Nigel Long, the umpire? I know it's the same man, but do you have a problem with him?
I don't say I've got a problem with him, but he's not my favourite umpire.
Okay.
Who is?
It's got to be Michael Gough, surely. The assertiveness.
He's too good. It's like saying Sachin Tendulkar's your favourite batsman.
But mine, for what it's worth, to fill this terrible period in our podcast history, is Morais. Little Morais, Erasmus. He's an absolute gun. Don't care whether he makes good decisions or not, although he is generally well-respected. I just love his vibe. Love the way he goes about his business. He just cheers me up whenever I see him. So he's comfortably, hands down, my favourite. By the way, Joe, I don't want you to lose track of your Kent AXA Equity and Law 94 side, but I knew you were going to say Trevor Ward. When the question came up this morning, I was thinking about who other people would say, and I knew, top of the list, I knew it would be Big Trev. I knew it. Yeah. You speak about him more than you might otherwise realise. You know, you're a very well-rounded individual, but Trevor Ward is there in your consciousness. And I knew you'd say him.
Who's in your consciousness from the 90s, Phil?
Well, the problem I've got here is that when the first people I thought, I recognised them as county cricketers, but they've all played international cricket. So I don't know if this counts, but...
Yeah, I think that counts.
Okay, all right. Well, my favourites... Peter Such is one of my all-time favourite cricketers. Lovable, much underrated, helped Essex win a number of championships, but was also my first coach. So he coached me batting. England's worst ever batsman, ever, was my first ever batting coach. And he was basically trying to make ends meet at the time. He played a bit at Notts, a bit at Leicester, not really made the grade at either club, partly because his fielding was not much and his batting was hilarious. But he landed at Essex and they brought him on, and he was a kind of twos player-ish really in the late 80s, early 90s. But he found his natural home at Essex really, and he was making ends meet over the winter doing some coaching, and I got to know him as I'd have been, what, 10 or 11? And he got me into the Essex team. Right, he sorted me out, got me into the Essex team. So when he had two or three good years and ended up making his debut for England in 93, I bunked off school that day, bought a load of dry roasted peanuts and Coca-Cola, and sat and watched him take six for over the first 2 days of that game. And that was one of my all-time favourite cricketing memories, because I felt for the first time like attached to it, you know, in a sort of folksy sort of way. So Peter Such, one of my all-time favourite cricket people. Again, keeping it parochial, Stuart Law was phenomenal for Essex and later for Lancs, but I watched him mainly at Essex. John Crawley, I had this habit of watching John Crawley play well in county cricket. He always seemed to get runs whenever I happened to go and watch Lancs and then Hampshire and so on, and a joy really, and a much unfulfilled international talent. And the other one that I thought of this morning was Gihan Mendis, who was an opening bat at Lancashire, a bit similar to Trevor Ward in Joe's shout. Ahead of his time, Sri Lankan descent, and had a kind of dash and daring to him. This would have been, again, in the early late 80s, early 90s, an opening batsman at Lancashire. I always used to wear a short sleeve jumper. He had, you know, Imran Khan style locks as well. And he just used to go out there, stay leg side of it, and absolutely pulverise it through the offside. Was very hit and miss, was a bit cantankerous, apparently, a bit tricky to manage in the dressing room. But my sort of cricketer, and again, one of these cricketers, again, if he played now, then he'd have been a world name. I've got loads more, but let's move on. We've got a lot to get through.
Ben, have you got a standout player from the 2000s?
Yeah, well, continuing the theme of, I guess, hard-hitting openers is Ali Brown for me. In that, obviously, I was quite a late convert to cricket and it having sort of like a maths background or whatever. I was sort of playing catch-up, I guess, when I first started realising, like, yeah, this is the thing I want to be, you know, this is what I want my favourite thing to be. So going through all these like lists of records and stuff, and then just going through that list of highest individual scores in List A cricket and seeing this guy on there twice from like what would have been like 10 to 15 years ago at the time, and the, making these scores that even now seem kind of like unfeasible and ridiculous, and in team totals that were also unfeasible and ridiculous, and thinking like, and also a guy that I'd never heard of, wasn't like it was looking back and seeing, you know, Lara or Tendulkar had done this. It was just a guy at that point who I'd never heard of who was on this list twice as having played like these absolutely ridiculous innings, kind of spokes. And I didn't realise then that, you know, there was actually sort of a lot of history with Shadani Brown and played more for England or whatever. I just thought this was a kind of a every dog has his day, but twice kind of thing, that he just had a day out a couple of times.
How soon into your cricket watching experience were you looking up the highest ever scores in List A cricket?
Well, pretty soon. I guess when you go to a boarding school, there's often not a huge amount to do. And then when you're, because also a lot of the, getting into cricket originally, it wasn't able to like watch it so much as following it on Cricket Info, and then you're able then to get very quickly into just this like absolute massive records, and that's obviously that's the dream. I also have I've picked out I don't know if it's a favourite umpire, but I was reading about the Shakil Rana Mike Gatting affair recently, and I love Shakil Rana's vibe basically as sort of like one of the great heels, to use a wrestling term in cricket, and especially as an umpire who was supposed to be these guys who sort of like control the game and sort of keep it going and sort of calm things down, and he just absolutely didn't do that at any point whatsoever. It was just antagonizing wherever he could. I think that's kind of great.
So you went to a boarding school?
Yeah, you knew that.
I didn't know you'd been a boarder.
Yeah,
it's all beginning to fall into place.
Yeah,
you don't have to apologize, Ben.
my first favorite county cricketer, I was thinking about my first memories of county cricket were that Gloucester team that was really good at the start of the 21st century. And Ian Harvey was definitely the most fun player in that team. So definitely him as my favourite. But that was just a very fun team overall. Like Craig Spearman batting the top, Mark Alleyne, Jack Russell. I think John Lewis was in the team by then. So that was very fun. Anyway, moving on. Jack asks, what's a wicket that cemented itself in your mind? It doesn't have to be particularly special, just one you vividly remember and you can't seem to shift. Ben, do you want to go first?
Yeah, I mean, all the ones I could think of were special in some sort of way. Like, one of the ones when I close my eyes and I see it on a loop is Archer in the Bangladesh game in the World Cup, the one that hits the top of off stump and then the ball goes for six. That was just like, it's just so beautiful. Like, the arc the ball follows is really lovely. Obviously, a couple of absolutely awful ones, like the Ijaz Ahmed one, the sort of the weird no shot thing that takes out his middle stump, and Ian Bell in that test in India, the one where is it first ball that he comes down and just plops it straight to, yeah, that wasn't great. And then also the Maxwell leave, which is obviously now quite they use it as a meme sort of thing, like my parents aren't home, and then he runs out and then just like looks like he's going to smash it and then leaves it and it crashes into middle stump. Those are the ones for me, I guess. But yeah, they're all sort of special. Like there's a sort of a type of dismissal that you have in your mind, the ones that you sort of shadow bat. So the sort of the ruining one off the length that you sort of go like that and fend it and it takes your glove. But that's not a specific dismissal. That's just a type of dismissal that is kind of burned in there, I guess.
Joe, what about you?
Well, I initially read this as dismissals this year. So I was thinking purely from this year. The first ball of the series we're not talking about will take some shifting from my memory, I think. But also earlier this summer, Bumrah cleaning up Bairstow at the Oval second innings, having what, bowled Pope in the, I think the previous over. You know, Bairstow gets bowled quite a lot in Test cricket, but I think a lot of batsmen really got done by that one. It's just an outrageous piece of bowling from that was probably the most memorable spell for me of from the Test summer. But then if we're going a bit further back, the combination of Ben talking about Leaves and Ian Bell brought to mind Bell at Centurion in 2009, I think it was, facing Paul Harris, who's obviously never spun the ball in his life, but Bell inexplicably decides to play for turn that was never coming and just leaves a straight one. I think it's middle stump that gets hit rather than off stump as well, from memory.
Could he have been leaving it on length?
I mean, it hit about halfway up, so not very well if he was. And that series, Bell was coming under serious fact. I think by that point, he still hadn't scored a 100 in innings where another England batsman hadn't, which was a stat that kind of stuck with him for a while. But then only two games later, or maybe one game later at Durban, he scored a brilliant 100 in a big win for England at Durban, which was kind of quite a big moment in Bell's career. But yeah, one of those tours that kind of sums up the beauty and madness of Ian Bell all in one.
That Ian Bell stat sums up for me how good that England team was, that a legitimate complaint about a batter was they only get hundreds when someone else has scored 100. Not a problem that the current England team have. Phil, what about you?
First two ones that came to my head were James Vince at Brisbane and Michael Atherton at Lords in 93, and they're both run outs. So it's not really a sort of celebration of cricketing greatness of, you know, Bumrah or Wazim or whoever who've been around the corners. It's more just human pain and tragedy and what might have been. And for some reason, my brain just took me there straight away, clear as day, vividly. The Vince one is your classic sliding doors moment. And the Atherton one had a very significant effect on me in my formative years following the game. It didn't change my outlook of cricket, but it made me understand it a lot more. And I realised that the whole thing is predicated on human fallibility and farce. And then I picked out three or four others just straight away, and I'll be brief, but ones that I've actually seen. So stuff that I've seen live and stuck in my mind. Craig White's first ball dismissal of Lara at the Oval in 2000 was an extraordinary moment. And Lara to be bowled round his legs from a player who hadn't really been particularly heralded, but sort of for that year, that summer, encapsulated a kind of emergent England side after a few years of misery and toil. And to clean up Lara in the big one, when they were 2-1 up going into that Oval Test match, and they needed obviously to win to get that monkey off their back that had been hanging around for years, 30-odd years it was. 31 years, I think it was, since they'd beaten the West Indies in a series. So that was an extraordinary moment. England went on to win that game. Sachin at the Oval in, what would it have been,
2011? Tim Bresnan.
I think he was on 80 something or other, and he was on 99 Test Match 100s, and everyone knew this was going to be his last ever hit in England. And Tim Bresnan got him out with one that was clipping the top of leg stump, I think it was. I can't remember who the umps was, although I've got a feeling it might have been Rudy Kirsten, but I might be throwing him under the bus unfairly there. Anyway, he was given out for 80-odd, and I remember, irrespective of who you were following, irrespective of the score in the series and all the rest of it, the air just sucked out of the ground, realising that, you know, as ever, we're on the verge of history and cricket does its thing. It rips it apart for you right at the death. And the other one, of course, is Anya's final wicket at Lords in 2017 to get rid of India's number 11, Gaikwad. And yeah, that day's probably my all-time favourite day at the cricket, I would say.
I was kind of in a mode of thinking of like what were my first favourite things, if that makes sense. And I think one of the first test series I properly threw myself into in terms of like watching most balls would have been England in West Indies 2003-04. West Indies series are just quite good to watch from a viewing time. Like you, after school, you can watch pretty much the whole thing. And that series, you obviously had the Harmison 7 for nothing, but it's actually the Hoggard hat-trick that sticks in my head the most. So I think he got Ganga and Sawan out caught in around, in the gully region, I think both times. And then hat-trick ball is to Shiv Chanderpol, and it's a classic right-arm swing bowl dismissal to a left-handed batter. Full pitching on middle, swinging into them, absolutely plum. And I used to be able to swing the ball away, so Holroyd was my favourite cricketer back then. So seeing him do something special was quite cool. And I think that was the first series where I was like properly obsessed. I'd liked cricket for a while, but that was the first series I was properly obsessed with it.
Joe Harmon, modest to a fault, hasn't mentioned cleaning up that 13-year-old in the game he played earlier this summer. First ball. Gave him the send-off as well. It was a beautiful moment. That always sticks in my mind.
Do you know what? I was going to mention it, but then I remembered a mum of one of the players messaged us afterwards, and I thought it would seem a bit cheap to bring it up again. Within a few months, but it was wind assisted. I would admit, but yeah, it was a beauty, no doubt about it.
We didn't get to see how good he was because you got him out so early. But judging by how good the rest of that team of 13-year-olds were, he was probably very, very good.
He was meant to be their best player, genuinely.
of course he was.
Not just giving myself a pat on the back. That was the review afterwards.
Matt Oss, if you could gift wrap one moment from the 2021 cricket year and give it to a member of the pod, what would you choose and who would you give it to? I've thought long and hard about this, and I am giving Ben a framed copy of Shane Warne's tweet during the England-India series where he wrote, "Here's a thought for the second innings. Crawley opens with Archer, Broad at three, and say tee off, brackets, not recklessly, but aggressive." And then basically listed out what he thought the England order should be, which had Sibley at eight, Folkes at nine, Archer opening and Broad at three.
Did he really? He's winding us up, right?
No, he genuinely tweeted that. That was when England were getting bowled out for nothing in India early in the year.
It was the pink ball test, I think, yeah.
Yeah. Anyone else got anything?
I'll jump in here because I also wanted to get something framed and given to Ben. We haven't planned this. Clearly, we haven't planned it. I'd print out and frame the web page of the Daily Mail's hatchet job on woke Ben Gardner and gift wrap it to the great man. I think that would be mine. Blow it up, A1 style, stick it above your bed.
I think Ben's already done that. Woke.
That'd be right. I'd hang that up. Mine's just quite nice. I was imagining it's sort of an NFT situation, so I thought I'd get Joe an NFT of either Kent winning the T20 blast or that Jordan Cox fielding effort on the boundary, which I thought must have been quite a nice moment because it was a nice moment for me, even with no emotional connection to Kent. You know, Darren Stevens saying, "Get us the final and I'll win it." It's just a nice game.
Would that make you Christmas, Joe?
I mean, that's very thoughtful. I still don't really understand what NFTs are, but I'm nonetheless grateful. So you'd get a confused but grateful response, I think, to that.
Yeah, I have absolutely no idea what they are either. Joe, have you got a present for anyone?
Mine's for Phil, actually, given that he's struggling with COVID and not going to have much company. So I've gift-wrapped Darren Lawrence's test debut at Gaul for Phil, which had been obviously much heralded by Phil, particularly on this show for a good couple of years. And then it eventually arrived. And Lawrence stepped up, obviously made a beautiful 73 in the first innings and then a gutsy 21 to see them home in the second innings. And the next star of English batting was born. Obviously hasn't quite worked out like that since, but there is still time.
And I know can I ask you lot, just sorry to mention it, we're not mentioning the thing, but Do you think he's got a chance at that level? And do you think, objectively, he was reasonably treated, considering he's not really even a part of the conversation? And three innings ago, he was 20 minutes away from making his maiden test 100 against the best team in the world. That might be a leading question. I don't know. I'm just interested because I'm not allowed to talk about him anymore because I get a load of stick for it and I get that. So I'm just interested in other people's opinions.
Well, it's interesting to see. Yaz asked a bunch of us to pick our sides for the Melbourne test. This is definitely Ashes. And I think, did all of us pick Lawrence or four of us pick Lawrence?
I think three out of four.
Which again, might be that echo chamber in kind of working well. But, you know, my argument was, we still don't know. So you can bring back in Besto and he's got this track record of failure. Lawrence, we still don't know. And he's certainly, I don't think there's much doubt he's got the attitude and confidence for it, but we're still none the wiser, really, whether his technique is going to hold up against the best bowlers, against the quickest bowlers. But I think this series, given the way it's going, is a great chance to learn quite a lot more heading into next summer. So that's non-committal, isn't it? We've tipped so many young English batters to come good and they haven't done it. I'm reluctant to do so again, but I think he's got as good a chance as most of them, really. I'd still put Pope at the top, despite his travails, but I don't think Lawrence is too far behind. We've absolutely got to see more of him.
Yeah, I'm not going to say Dan Lawrence nailed on for 100 tests, but I think the one thing that's usually working in his favour is how, and I know his test record so far doesn't stand out, but I think he's shown that he can like work situations out on the fly, and you know, he made his debut in that Sri Lanka series where, you know, conditions are pretty alien, played brilliantly in that last test in India when, you know, everyone else couldn't get a run and he was batting at number seven. And just he had figured out a way to score runs in a situation where no one else was able to do that. And even similarly in that New Zealand innings, I think he started really scratchily. And that's the one, I guess, concern is that he does seem like a very scratchy starter. But then when he gets in, he does seem like he can work out situations, which is quite a valuable trait, I think, and something that might not exactly translate from county cricket, where you get presented with the same situation quite a lot, I guess. That's the one thing I really like. In terms of the gif of Phil, I wonder if it'd be the innings itself or the interview that his dad gave to the BBC.
That would have been better, actually. That would have been a better shout, yeah.
I'm broadly on the same page as the other two. I think he should... I'd want to see him play ahead of Bairstow. People keep going on about Bairstow's got 100 in Australia, but he averages 27 in Australia from a reasonable sample size. I know that's the same as what Lawrence averages in Test cricket, but Lawrence hasn't played that much. Bairstow averages 21 over 3 years. Lawrence made a name for himself by scoring loads of runs in Australia. I'd like to see him play. Do I think he's going to have a long Test career? I don't know. I think a little bit similar to Sibley, he looks so bad when he gets out early on. I think that's held against him a little bit more than it would do somebody who plays in a more classical way. But yeah, he's from 8 Test matches, you can already list 4 very good innings, I think, which is decent going and definitely better than a lot of the other English guys this year. Anyway, Phil, nice subtle hijacking of the pod there. But moving back to listeners' questions, I think this is my favourite question. The Run Out blog asks, what's the worst you've ever seen a Test player bat for 100? Anyone want to go first?
I'll jump in. Do you remember Mark Richardson, the Kiwi the opener?
Great shout, Joe.
Kiwi spinner. Number 10, number 11 turns Test opener and got a very good record. I looked up again this morning, averaging 45 in Test cricket. But God, was he awful to watch. He was just absolutely terrible. And there was one Test in particular, 2004 Lord's Test, which is better remembered for obviously Strauss's debut 100, Nasser running out Strauss, Nasser scoring his 100 and then retiring. But in the midst of that, Richardson just stunk the place out with... I was there for certainly the final day when England chased the runs down and an earlier day. And I can't even remember if I saw Richardson score 100 or not because it was so bleak. But he got 93 off 266 balls in the first innings and then 101 from 309 balls in the second. So, to all intents and purposes, he had a great game, but no one will have enjoyed watching it. I can't remember if it was bad in the sense that there were catches put down or terrible shots played, but it was just horrendous to watch. And yeah, I think although his Test career was very productive, not many will have kind of fond memories of actually having watched him bat because it was kind of Gary Kirsten on a bad day.
Yeah, the only thing I think that people enjoyed watching him bat was when he got cramp that time, which is one of the funniest cricket videos that's out there. Yeah. He's probably in the 90s, I think, he scored 90-odd runs and goes for a sweep shot and it's quite a hot day. And then so it's like a half a beat after you play the sweep shot, which makes it funnier. He then just does this kind of quite melodic, high-pitched scream and twists around. There's loads that's funny about it, like the way he stretches his bat out to get it back into the crease. Obviously, the commentator's laughing. It's quite like the Wilhelm scream. I don't know if you know the sound effect that's used in quite a lot of old Hollywood movies. It's basically exactly that. And then there's a slow-mo where it's like pitch shifted down about 2 octaves. It's an amazing moment.
And of course, the other thing he's famous for is being incredibly slow. So he would race after every series that New Zealand played. He would race the slowest member of the opposition team. So he raced Ashley Giles around the outfield at the conclusion of this series. I think he raced Darren Lehman as well. I think he beat Giles. I think he just about came out on top, but he would come out in this proper like sprint suit. It was good. It was kind of good amateur days. This was actually test cricket, and you've got a bloke kind of celebrating how slow he is against another bloke celebrating how slow he was.
Not enough of that these days. Any others?
Well, obviously I've got loads. I'll keep them very brief, I promise. In no particular order, Matthew Hayden's 380 should be banned. Line through that one.
You can't disregard a 380. You've got to explain a little bit more than that.
Yeah, you can. You can completely disregard it. It was ugly and awful and cruel and unnecessary. Mike Gatting's otherwise heroic 117 at Adelaide, 94-5. Bless him. Shouldn't have been on the tour. Didn't get more than 20 in any other innings. Was redolent of all the problems with English cricket at the time, and yet somehow managed to scratch his way to 100 at Adelaide. I mean, you can absolutely say it was heroic. You can also say it was rather bleak. The worst of the worst of the worst. Oh, yeah. Alistair Cook's pink ball nastiness. Edgbaston, West Indies. Awful. 290-odd. The worst of the worst, that I, and again, I saw this live, was Paul Collingwood, otherwise estimable cricketer and all the rest of it. He made 100. I've spoken to Joe about this before. He made 100 at Lord's against the West Indies on day two when England were already 380-odd and he comes out at six. This was the game that O.A. Shah played and he gloved one for six or seven-odd, never played again. Peterson didn't get any either. But I think Cook had made 100. I think Strauss might have made 100. Collie comes in with England already on the verge of declaring. No one likes to see it when the West Indies are playing at Lord's. You want to see a good game. And Collie was dropped half a dozen times, bowled off 17 no balls, you know, skewed it up in the air. Everything was down to third man or squirreled through mid-wicket, all the rest of it. And he clambered his way to 100. That, again, appears on the honours board, that 100. It's up there. It's absolutely up there. Again, that's another one. You should just stick a line straight through that one. Unforgivable knock by the great man.
I've got one that might get me even more hatred from the Daily Mail or somewhere else. It's not a Test 100, but it is by a Test player. It's Sachin's 100th 100.
Nice.
I don't know if you remember the game or the situation, but he was batting quite well. He got to, was on 80 off about 100, which was a decent rate for then. And it felt like he did this quite a lot when he got close to the 100th, and it would kind of the enormity of it, and just, you know, all those eyeballs would just eventually tell. But then in this game, he just kind of dug in and then spent absolutely ages getting from there to his 100. It was like 20 off his last 40 balls to get there. So India were only one down, I think. So having looked like they were going to make 350, ended up making up just shy of 300. Bangladesh then chase it down. And that's the loss that kind of knocks India out of that year's Asia Cup. So he's obviously got his amazing personal milestone, but it is sort of in my head, the epitome of the kind of match losing innings, I guess.
He's never recovered since, has he?
Yeah, exactly.
That's a very good answer. Again, mine's not 100. It was a match winning innings that was given a lot of praise. It was Jermaine Black was 91 against England last year. It was a terrible innings. He did not bat well. He was dropped a few times, played and missed loads, and everyone, and he's like, in all these, including ours, end of year list as best innings of the year. It was rubbish. Like, if you actually watched it, it's one of those that looks great in the scorecard. He's like, oh, he's West Indies lost a few early wickets, and he shepherded the lower middle order in the tail home, but he actually didn't bat that well. Similarly,
brutal
ODI cricket, but also from last summer. Alex Carey got 100 in a really good Australia run chase against England. Maxwell batted amazingly. Carey didn't at all, I thought. And then he got out at a really crucial point after Maxwell was out. And they only actually won because Mitchell Stark hit. Adil Rashid bowled the last over and Mitchell Stark hit him for six off the first ball. So Carey actually got out at a very bad time, and I don't think batted that well in the innings up to then. So those are my two. Not really answering the question, but there we go. This should be fun. Luke asks, what's your most controversial or questionable cricket opinion? His is, he believes that night watchmen should be banned. We were asked a variation of this question by Cricket Visitor Ben Jones, where we would reveal other panellists' most controversial opinions rather than saying what our own ones are, but I think that's potentially a dangerous game to be playing.
We're not playing that game.
Yeah, we're not going to do that. Does anyone want to be brave enough to go first here?
Yeah, I've got one. I've been wanting to get off my chest. And I appreciate this is coming from a very privileged position where I don't have to pay for many test tickets myself, but I don't care about overrates. I just don't. And I wish we didn't talk about them as much on this podcast, on commentary. Even when I do pay for a test match day, if I go along and watch 87 overs, I don't come away furious that I've missed out on three. And the amount of energy that goes into debating this topic, which I think on the grand scheme of things, even within cricket, is not a particularly big issue. I just don't mind that much. It just doesn't get me going, apart from the fact it gets me going when everyone talks about it.
That's a good answer. I find this quite difficult because a lot of what I think are controversial opinions are just like whether or not I rate a player or not. And it sounds a bit harsh saying so-and-so shit, so-and-so shit.
Our cherry festive, you're just going to write off a series of careers just based on...
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm not going to do that. So what am I to? One, the 10-11 win in Australia, slightly overhyped. Australia weren't that great. There's one. Number two, and I really don't want to spend time actually arguing this, so let's just move on after I say it. I don't think the sandpaper lot got long enough bans. I think the moralising was overdone, but from a purely cricketing point of view, that's like that's the purest form of cheating. And I think it could have been harsher, should have been harsher. From a purely cricketing point
of view. I didn't know you thought this. That's ludicrous.
Let's move on. anyone else?
I think four-day tests could be a laugh and fun and progressive if everyone behaved themselves and bowled the overs that they needed to bowl during the day, but they won't. So it's probably a non-starter. But I think tactically and strategically, it could be an interesting option. And you'd certainly see, I think, many, many games of cricket that would have an extra element if they were played over four full days with maybe 100 overs per day. But that's not going to happen. And I'm probably going to get shot at dawn anyway for saying that. I've got others, but I've probably mentioned them before. As much as I love county cricket and the way that it's set up and all of that, I think if we were starting from scratch, would anyone in their right mind go anywhere near 18 clubs? Would anybody think that that's the best possible option for professional cricket?
So you're tentatively stepping towards culling a few counties for Christmas. Is this where you...
I mean, I wouldn't, Joe, because I'm a romantic, right? But I can absolutely understand the perspective that is trotted out whenever England play badly. It could do with, you know, streamlining, let's say. If we were starting from scratch, we wouldn't have 450 professional cricketers in a game that is not exactly overflowing with popularity.
I would like to at least trial an extreme simplification of the LBW law. Like, I just don't think it needs to be as complicated as I think. It doesn't matter where shouldn't matter where it's pitched or where it hits you on the pad. Just if you don't hit it and if it hits your pad and it was going to hit the stumps, you're out. And that would be much simpler and like you would remove one of the barriers to cricket that's often used for comic effect. I mean, I know people say it might encourage different types of bowling styles, but also people often say that lots of things will have lots of effects, like T20 will be the death of finger spin or, you know, loads of stuff like that, and it just doesn't end up being the case. So I would like to see a trial of how it affects the game, even if like maybe for like a season in some sort of competition, even if not an immediate switch to it.
Yeah, so you have to cut that. That's madness.
Well, I mean, no one has ever not got into cricket because of the LBW rule. I'm sorry. If you're that far in and you're kind of curious about the LBW rule, I mean, it's very straightforward to understand. No one has not got into cricket because of the LBW rule. Moving on, what's your number two?
I think a lot more catches are grounded than we think they are. And I also think that cricket needs a good definition of what the ground and being grounded is. Like, I know there's foreshortening of the lens and whatever, and that Tony Gregg did that nice segment, but your fingers can be underneath the ball and the ball can still be touching the ground. Those things are both possible. You can have a blade of grass sticking between the fingers. Does that count as grounded? I don't know. I mean, it's part of the ground, but is it the ground? I don't really know. You get a lot of catches where there's a diving catch and the bowler sort of lands on their palms, and those should be not out under the laws. Maybe you change the laws to do that, but that's just not considered. People just ignore it. So I think a lot more catches actually touch the ground before a player is fully in control of the ball and of their body than we actually see. And we probably just give catches credit because it's nice to give catches credit than because they actually fit within the laws as they are written.
Bang on, you're suggesting if a blade of grass is coming up between two fingers and touches the ball, that could be considered a grounded ball.
I'm not suggesting that exactly, but I also think that there isn't really a definition of grounded in the laws, and that is one not that implausible interpretation. I mean, if it's touching anything kind of outside the hands, like if that would count. I mean, but any, even if you're just taking, like, you're imagining it as if there's no grass and it's just the dirt underneath, it is possible for you to have your fingers under the ball and your fingers to be spread in a way, and as the ball kind of presses down and presses into your fingers, for it to press the ground, even if it is also pressing your fingers and your fingers underneath them at the same time. And that's something that doesn't just get discussed, I think.
A final question is from Paul, who asks, what can we look forward to for next year? Who are you folks tipping to be a breakthrough act, either in red or white ball cricket for 2022? Will it be a Hamid century, a Parkinson Fife from the Caribbean? Probably not that. Or someone else currently not on the radar?
I was trying to think sort of logically about this, about how a player is going to get into that England team. And there are quite a lot of spots there. But I think what we're going to see is quite an open first few rounds of the county season leading into the first test of the summer. And I quite fancy, kind of as he did this year, but he'll go a step further, Tom Abel, to have quite a storming run to the start of the season and then to come in and actually kind of look the part pretty early on. Like he's been around, said some tough times. He's highly rated. I really like watching him. I think there's quite a lot to like about him, so I could quite easily see that happening, I think.
One name we've talked about on the podcast before, and he's in the squad for the Caribbean, I think George Garton, I think will play quite a lot for England over the next year, and certainly in white ball stuff. He's a little bit of a way off in red ball. But we saw at the C20 World Cup, England's seam attack is still not, it's the weak link in their sides. Garton's now got a bit of IPL experience. He's a good batter. He's brilliant in the field, and he bowls quick, and his left arm, I think there's a lot going for him, so I think we'll see quite a bit of him playing for England. And something I'm just looking forward to watching Norkia in the flesh, live test matches next summer against England. I think that'd be really, really good. Not one that England's batters will be looking forward to especially, I wouldn't have thought, but it should be great watching.
I'm looking forward to the 4-day championship getting back to its original form. I was cautiously keen on it at the start of the summer last gone, but by the end of the summer I think we'd realised that it wasn't really workable as it was, so I'm looking forward to that being returned to its natural state. And if you want a name, well, Tom Lamonby is an interesting one, and England are going to be looking for opening batsmen who are more natural players than what they've currently been looking at or been looking at over the last 2 or 3 years. And I know he had a horror run last year at the start of his summer, having really played well the year before in that truncated summer. I think he's a very, very good natural player, and I thought it was interesting that he made runs in the white ball stuff this year, having made his mark in the red ball stuff. He's a very good player to watch. He's left-handed, he's tall, he's elegant, he plays the short ball well. I think it's natural for a player to emerge and then have a bad trot and then come round again. I think he's an interesting player to keep your eye on. And again, you know, the merry-go-round will begin. It will begin again. Harry Brook is very close. And if no one can score runs in England's top six, then all of these names become very relevant. And hope springs eternal, as they say.
Nice save for the county diehards out there, going from wanting to cull some of the counties to...
I don't want to cull anything, most, my friend. I don't want to cull anything.
In terms of looking forward to 2022 from an England point of view, I think Ollie Pope's drop in form opens a door that was previously closed to a whole category of players, so basically your stroke makers. So I think it's not unfeasible for a player, I'm going to say it, someone like James Vince to make number six, the number six spot their own. Vince, I don't think he has ever batted six for England, which seems... I think, to be his natural position. England, he's tried to get in the top three in recent years. And if it's not Vince, someone like Vince, maybe like a Harry Brook, maybe like a Joe Clark, could make that spot their own. Because I think previously you kind of viewed it as Stokes bats five, Root bats four, Pope bats six, keeper bat seven. And that was looked like that was completely sewed up. And that's now open to probably the most exciting type of batter that England have. And there are quite a few of them. I think that could be quite interesting in 2022, seeing who nails that spot down. There were other questions that I need to address. We had about 15 questions about the pod theme music.
Yeah, which this is important stuff.
Which I didn't really envisage happening. So basically, the original theme music to the pod was written and produced by Felix White of Maccabees and Tailenders fame. I don't know if listeners knew that. Ben, you said earlier today that it's available on Spotify if people want to just listen to the theme tune loads.
Yeah, it's under the artist's name Cosmo on the album called Cosmo, and it's the song is called Interlude, and Interlude is in brackets if you're searching for it. So yeah, go and dig that out.
Possible late run for Christmas number one. I think on this, you know, there's been backwards and forwards, as people are aware who listen to the show, but Felix's intro is literally the only cool thing about this podcast. So we couldn't get rid of that. That was the one thing keeping us above water in that sense. But I like the suggestion of having one at the start and one at the finish. Have we done that? And I just haven't noticed.
I think we've done that once or twice, but not often. It's been a slightly inconsistent. And yeah, the other pod music is actually composed and produced by Butch. So I guess we should have that one in there as well. Yeah, well, we should make a decision. Are we going with Felix at the start, Butch at the end?
Yeah,
cool. Agreed. Bye. Lots of nodding heads. That's what we're going to do then. I'm going to finish off with a couple of emails that we had in. One was from Chris, who wrote a couple of paragraphs about England's mishandling of spin bowlers, which we'll save for the next episode. But he finishes it by saying, "Can I also take this chance to apologise to the fellow cricket enthusiast I recently met at a wedding and spent a good hour explaining in detail why Matt Parkinson should get into the England team at 2 a.m. when I'm pretty sure he wanted to go to bed. Love the pod. Keep up the good work." Chris, we've all been there. We've all been there. And then finally, Hannah writes in to say, "Hello all, long time listening, first time emailer. No Ashes talk, too depressing. There was for me a massive glimmer of hope from 2021. Have we really quite gotten over how good the ODI series against Pakistan in the summer was with a completely different team? For me, it was the best cricket of the summer. A group of guys, some of whom will probably never play international cricket again, having an absolute blast on an England shirt and winning against a really good Pakistan side. The last game of the series was probably the cricket match of the summer, in my opinion. So many impressive performances from those on the fringes showing us what the next 5 to 10 years of ODI cricket might look like for England. I was beaming for a full week at a team who barely knew each other's names and yet acted like a fully fledged team. Some may call it beginner's luck, but I call it bloody good stuff. And as a biased Lancashire lass, seeing Sakeem Mahmood on show at the best of his abilities made me smile, whilst James Vince finally getting his England 100 brought a tear to my eye. Proper, proper good cricket. There are lots of things from 2021 that we need to review and improve, but I wanted to draw the eye to a series that is probably overlooked, but to me was the most entertaining part of the summer. I hope you're all happy and healthy, and I hope you enjoy your festive break. As someone fairly new to cricket, I'm a 2019 World Cup convert. Thank you for the podcast week in, week out. Bringing my eye to all types of cricket from all around the world. It's been a great release to an otherwise middling year for us all. All the best, Hannah from Bolton." What a lovely email. And yeah, that was a truly amazing series, wasn't it?
It's a great email, and I completely agree with Hannah as well. And the interview I did with John Simpson quite soon after that series was probably my favourite interview that I did of the year, because it was just so heartwarming. He was still kind of trying to kind of come back down to earth after what had happened, and just still obviously couldn't quite believe it. And Hannah's talking about us getting a kind of sneak preview of some of the guys who are going to be England stars in the years to come. Well, John Simpson obviously will probably never play for England again, and he was fully aware of that fact and just couldn't quite believe what had happened. And there was something, yeah, very, very special about that whole series. I loved it too.
A nice memory to end the show on. That's all for today. Thanks, Joe. Thanks, Phil. Thanks, Ben. And thank you, listeners, for sticking by us in this quite chaotic pod and also all year long. Hope you all have lovely Christmases, and we'll be back after the Boxing Day test. If you really enjoyed the show, please do consider leaving a nice review on the podcast app or leave us a 5-star rating on Spotify. Cheers.
Social Podcast Network.